Woohoo! Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
Actually, I don't know what day of the week. We got in late last night from California. It kind of simultaneously feels like Monday, Wednesday, and Sunday all at once.
Yeah, I'm operating on 6 hours of sleep right now, which I know to some new parents out there seems luxurious, but we're not quite at that point yet. Megan's just pregnant right now, not actually having given birth. So I don't know. Maybe this is good training for the future when I'll be working off like 2 hours of sleep or whatever new parents seem to get.
Meanwhile, I'm going in the opposite direction. I think I actually feel pretty good in pregnancy, honestly. Like, I think I'm handling it decently well compared to, like, sometimes in athletes, I've seen it just be kind of a horror show, which makes sense. You're growing a life. You're growing a human inside you. But my main pregnancy symptom has been that I sleep 11 hours a night. So I'm getting a horrible preparation for this. Like, when I actually give birth, my body is going to be jolted into the new reality of not sleeping 11 hours a night.
Yeah. So one funny thing since we talked about pregnancy that I've noticed is everyone says to you, congrats, this is amazing, all this other stuff. I've had so many people, especially dads, come to me and say, hey, you're never going to sleep. It sucks. Everything's terrible. But you know, it's worth it at the end. There's like a but at the end of it. You don't get those emails nearly as often as I do.
I don't get it quite at all. And in fact, I thought you were making it up. I was like, stop being such a drama queen. And then you showed me your text messages and you were indeed getting that information. But you know, I kind of feel like it's like when you get a puppy and everyone's like, good luck. It's going to be a lot of work.
Yeah.
And we absolutely loved, I mean, Addie was a little bit of a devil puppy for the first 6 weeks, but it was still great.
So you're saying having a kid is a lot like having a puppy? It's like kind of equal is what you're saying?
It's like having 12 puppies.
Okay. Yeah. Can we put our kid in the crate? I think we can. Why not? Why can't you put your kid in a crate?
I mean, a bassinet is kind of just like a beautiful crate, isn't it?
That's so
a crib. I mean, a crib looks a lot like a crate just without the top.
Why does the top change the moral calculus of what a crib is? I think a crib is just a crate. It's okay to just leave your kid in the crib and go for the day.
Honestly, I think the same goes for leashes too.
Yeah, it's so true. I have seen kids on leashes though. Have you ever seen that?
They disguise them as really cute looking book bags. So they stick like a book bag that's like a bumblebee on a kid's back and there's a very long leash that's attached to it. I've seen this.
I am such a fan. Okay, so we're getting back from California. It was such a fun trip. We're going to get into some of the things. But the first thing I wanted to reflect on is that my favorite part of California is not the big trees. It's not the beautiful weather. It's 102.1 radio station, hip-hop and R&B classics. It is the greatest.
And the way they operate is they basically play the same 10 songs on repeat. And I haven't quite figured out their algorithms. I think they change it every week. They play the same 10 songs on repeat every week. And it's the best. Like OO's throwback rap. And the first thing that we do when we land at SJC, San Jose Airport, is we get to rent a car. And we turn on 102.1.
Often it's on the rental car already. When it's not, I'm very disappointed. So what we're bringing today is some Ja Rule and Ashanti energy. We're saying we're the Ja Rule and Ashanti of running podcasts right now.
I was vibing so hard with Ashanti on this trip.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm like not skilled at all in the singing world. But for whatever reason, I have like two notes. And they overlapped perfectly with Ashanti. And so as a result, whenever Ashanti comes on, I'm like, I'm singing it. I'm rocking it. I'm balling.
You actually overlap really well with Ashanti and with Beyonce circa Destiny's Child. Both of them you hit perfectly and you were nailing those notes. And every single time I was like, this is an angel singing right now. This is remarkable.
It's because I grew up on Single Ladies. Always at like prom, I was dancing and I was always single all the time. And I was like feeling that Single Lady vibe. And the fact that I'm like ever like in a partnership today is wild.
Well, you are in a partnership. I wasn't sure if I was going to mention this, but right before we started the podcast, I took off my shirt because we have this rule that we do not podcast with clothes on. And as I took off my shirt and I started to put it on the ground, Megan grabbed it from me and then smelled it. Why did you do that?
You have this like interest. I mean, I think it like smells good, but sometimes it's like a loving, I am like such a pregnant woman right now.
Yeah.
I'm saying this and I'm realizing I'm like, oh my gosh, Megan, this is like textbook pregnancy. But something about your like, the way that you waft is, it feels homey to
the
me.
Way that I waft to bring my,
You know, I'm all about it. I'm like, I'm feeling those vibes.
Well, you know how they say that pregnant women nest or whatever? This is much like a bird nesting. You know, the birds nesting will pick up like old pieces of paper and scraps off the ground. You're picking up my shirt and it's like, I need this for my nest.
Actually, the way that we've been nesting is like reverse nesting.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if this is how you're supposed to nest, but we're just throwing a lot of shit out.
Yeah.
We are like, we're like getting rid of all the clutter in our house, getting rid of all the excessive things that we paid bills on. It's great.
I think just streamlining our lives in general.
That's
like figuring out ways to streamline the work. We have some really really exciting podcast announcements possibly coming up in the next few weeks that might be relevant to this. Yeah, it's been good. It's been really good to nest.
It's been an interesting way to take stock of what we care about, uh-huh. because like we are streamlining a lot of things, but then with a podcast, we're kind of like dreaming big in some yeah. sense, because we really love, like, this is, I would say, the highlight by far of my work week. And then so it's like, well, let's magnify that. Like, if we're streamlining the rest of these things, we can put more time into this podcast, more time into like tangential things related yeah. to this podcast, which is a little bit of a teaser. So yeah,
we have some possible expansion stuff coming up. That'll be really fun. But yeah, so thank you for sniffing my shirt.
And it was rewarding.
Yeah. And that's how I feel about your panties.
That is weird. Okay, it would have been different if it had been like, first of all, you don't wear boxers, so I would have to like sniff your dress pants for the same aura. Oh. But like, I mean, instead of wearing sweatpants, do you wear dress pants? It's very interesting and very weird. But panties was one level too far.
It wasn't too far. Well, you don't wear panties either, so what am I supposed to do?
I have the underwear lining on shorts, close enough.
It's true. Sometimes.
Actually, sometimes when I'm feeling real good, I wear thongs.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's suffering for me. So there has to be a good reason. I need to like either feel the swag of the thong, or I'm like really looking to impress you.
I heard a quote from a dentist recently that was like, only floss the teeth you plan to keep. As like, it's kind of like,
I kind of respect that dentist.
On thongs, only floss the butt you wish to keep. That is my mantra. But yeah, so California was so fun. And actually, before leaving for California, we had a really interesting experience with Addy Dog. I'm curious if any other pregnant women out there have had this. So what happened out there?
So we're going to do our handoff to Addy Dog to your parents. And Addy goes to what we call Camp Roach. And yeah. she goes to this like incredible mountain experience when we travel with your parents. And your parents seem to love it, or at least they tell us. And Addy absolutely adores it. Like, she gets special time. She's in the mountains. She gets all kinds of treats, possibly marijuana. Yeah.
She has gotten high there multiple times.
She has all kinds of fun things going on. But she actually like refused to go. This time, this was last week, she just parked at my feet, literally sat on my feet and refused to go. And this is probably a broader reflection that we've seen in pregnancy, where she's been very protective and affectionate of me at the same time. And I think it's because she senses, she's like, mom's got a baby.
She knows there's a bun in the oven, and Addy is always going to stop for a bun every single time.
Actually, she's already just competing for food. She's like, yeah. Mom, I'm the firstborn.
I think it's more that she's playing the long game. Like, she's doing a Warren Buffett investment strategy where she's like, okay, if this kid does come out and this kid gets born and this kid's healthy, at about one, this kid's going to be giving me a lot of food. Like, I'm pretty sure that our kid is just going to be channeling Addy a metric crap ton of crumbs. So Addy's just like, I know how this works. I'm playing the long calorie game.
So true. She's all about that calorie bomb. But actually, I got very curious, because I was like, surely I think this is like a common phenomenon. I was reading anecdotes online of yeah. dogs becoming very protective and very affectionate of their pregnant owners. And so Addy is fitting this like scheme to a T, but there's no research on it.
Wow.
I went like full. I was like going into like the veterinarian, like doing veterinarian lit searches, and couldn't find anything. But it makes sense, because if you think about it, dogs are usually in tune. Like, if you train a dog, they can sense insulin levels. They can, there are service dogs that sense seizures for their owners before yeah. they happen. And so dogs are so attuned to like our hormones and our smells. And even probably like, we've probably changed our behaviors a bit yeah. since being pregnant. And it's kind of wild for me to think about all the different ways that she's picking that up.
Well, maybe it's your farts that she's smelling. Yes,
those are extra odiferous.
People don't talk about that in pregnancy, that it really slows down your GI tract.
Oh, that's actually one of the worst parts. Yeah.
Yeah, you had an experience with that this weekend. There was just like, it all sometimes adds up at once, which is very strange. I mean, pregnancy is this whole body alteration. Like, everything gets changed on a fundamental level, from your GI system to your hormones to your body composition.
To my boobs.
To your... That is true. And it must be so weird to live, because I'm so sensitive to the most minor changes in my own body. And like, how are you dealing with that? How are you feeling about that as it relates to like, not just being an athlete, but being a human? It just feels like a mindfuck.
It's weird. It's also cool at the same time. Yeah. Like, I think it's weird and uncomfortable and gross. And I fully express the true honesty of how all that feels across other podcasts that we've done on here. But I'm also just like now embracing the curiosity element of it, and like trying to love what's going on. I'm embracing my heavy boobs, embracing my slow GI tract, embracing all the other different parts of it.
Find yourself in a veterinary journal for heifers.
I was actually thinking, you know, we have the Walker Ranch cows. It's yeah. like the what we describe as our training group. I'm like, I'm officially the heifer.
Well,
actually, not quite yet.
No, I think heifers are we talked about heifers before on the podcast, and someone emailed and said, I believe that they are cows that have not yet had their first like offspring.
Oh, so that's me.
I'm not sure if pregnancy changes it. If you officially become a cow when you give birth or when you get pregnant, but I assume you're still a heifer. So
what is the, we have to figure out what is the heifer ceremonial rite of passage.
I don't know. That's a good point. We need to like, I don't know, burn some candles.
One of our podcast listeners surely knows.
Oh no, we have a lot of cow experts I have learned from past. Okay. So we were in California and we were there because you were helping lead a conference or something. It was very cool what you're doing. We haven't really talked about of your work too much.
I do a lot of lifestyle medicine related work. So I think at Stanford, I spend 50% of my time thinking about like the classic performance related research. So improving performance, optimizing performance, preventing injury, basically all in the athletic population.
Yeah.
And then I spend the other 50% of my time actually just in like the broader population health sense, thinking about physical activity, wellness, lifestyle behaviors. And it's really fun, actually. Like I think sometimes I struggled with the fact of thinking about my work being so performance focused. Yeah. And it's nice to have this broader application of it. So yeah, I was back in town for a really low key conference, which actually had a lot more people than I was expecting.
Yeah.
And we had a little community booth set up for Stanford Lifestyle Medicine. And I was doing squat assessments and lifestyle medicine assessments. And I'd say the average age was about 70. So very different population than I typically work with in my coaching work. And it was fun.
I loved it so much. So I got to see these videos of you doing squat like practice with what looked like 75-year-olds.
Yeah,
or so.
They were crushing me.
Yeah, yeah.
They were way better at it than I was. I was actually going to demonstrate my form, and I was like, halt. Your form is perfect. Let me improve mine.
Oh, well, pregnancy provides a convenient excuse, doesn't it?
It really does, actually. I got quite sore. So I probably did, in the process of helping like correct people's squats, I probably did like 200 squats myself. I woke up the next day blasted sore. Like so I was actually quite embarrassed about being sore from a lifestyle medicine conference, but I was.
Yeah. I mean, that could partially be pregnancy. It could partially just be like, squats are hard. Squats are kind of impossible. Even though I do a lot of strength work, I don't do squats right now. And if I went and just put like the bar on my back and did a set of 20 squats, I would be sore for at least a week. It would be so bad. I mean, and I'm not joking around. I would be way more sore from those squats than I would be from running a 50K over mountains down this terrain.
Oh, I mean, I do. I've been gradually working back into strength training after I had, all the issues with my heart. But it's funny how like even just like adding in one varied movement and doing it again and again and again, it's interesting how it really adds up. But the trip was a broader reflection. I mean, I think it's interesting. I love working in person.
Yeah.
Like I think I really miss that in-person element of work. And so there's a part of me that gets really nostalgic for California. And I almost want to have like, our life in Colorado is amazing. Like we spend a lot of time in the mountains. Like we live on this like little farm in Boulder and I just love it. But it's almost like there's a piece of me that's really nostalgic for California. And I wish that in some ways, we could almost have like two homes, even though that's virtually impossible, given many different constraints in California. But this trip was a helpful reflection on the fact that maybe it's because we're nesting. Yeah. Just how much I love Colorado and the fact that like maybe I was idealizing California a little bit too.
Well, Colorado is where we have our big stacks of panties and new shirts. So where else would we go? I mean, I think it's interesting to think about place in general, and that like it's easy to idealize places you've been or places you could go, but everywhere can be amazing. Like I feel like North Carolina, where we met, is just as much our home as anything else. And so, I guess home really is where, as you said, with nesting, it's like where your love is, like where you find yourself feeling most like comfortable. And I do not feel comfortable in California other than 1021. The traffic is terrible. There's like 5 million people right there. Everything is expensive. It's really hard.
Gas is basically $7 a gallon right now. It's insane in California. And sometimes when we drive around California, I get really excited when I see like a dilapidated house and I'm like, that could be ours. Like we could potentially live there. And then I Zillow it and it's $3 million.
Yeah.
And so actually I did a little like search on the average house prices in Palo Alto right now. The average house price according to Zillow in Palo Alto is $4.01 million.
Oh.
And the median house price is 3.1, which is bonkers.
Yeah.
Then if you want to commute 90 minutes to Stanford from Santa Cruz, the average house price there is 1.5. But still, that was actually a really helpful reflection just to fully close the door on ever wanting to live part-time in California, because I was like, oh man, logistically, that sounds like a nightmare. Also, we just can't do it.
Well, and I also love it because you're making such a difference through Stanford, but you can do it, you're doing it so much in all these different mediums, whether it's podcasts or writing or, you know, your million Zoom meetings, that you can kind of be anywhere. And so it's great to have the resources of Stanford at your disposal, but without the, you know, place, like being at Stanford, which is just a shit show in terms of like house prices and things like that. And just day-to-day life is so much more complicated there, I think, than some other places.
Yeah. And even thinking about like schools there for like a kid, like there's so many parts about that that become complicated, and our life here in Boulder is really ideal. And it was helpful just to like make that realization, but also to make the realization too, that I can go back there on periodic trips and work remote and still feel like it's home in a special way. And we don't necessarily have to have a house or apartment or like a set structure there. And I feel like I'm much more at peace with that.
We can live under a bridge.
Yeah,
it seems
exactly.
Like the best option. to broaden it out, my message to everyone, I've said this, I think once on the podcast before, is move. Like just move. And not actually, but to challenge yourself to think about that process, because I think so many people, and I see this in coaching, I'm like, why are you where you are? And it's because of almost like a mistake of confluence of factors when they were 18 or something. And I'm like, consider trying somewhere else. I think it's the best way to stir the pot on your life if you're not fully settled down and like nested there. So yeah, my challenge to people listening is, just like I said before, quit your job, move as well.
And I think too, we've had a lot of people comment that we're so lucky to live in Boulder. And I agree, like we've had a lot of privilege in our life that has set that in motion. But I think at the same point in time too, we've also made a lot of sacrifices to live here in Boulder. Like, you know, I was working a in-person gig in California.
Yeah.
Like that location was just not feeling right. And so we made the leap to move. And I think like we also have made a lot of sacrifices, and it was a scary leap to do that. And it was worth it.
Well, on our first date, you said that you wanted to move to Colorado eventually, even though you'd never been.
I had never been. And I was like, that's where I want to go. And
yeah.
Here we are.
You manifested it. You dream boarded Colorado into existence and our weird dog that sits at your feet and smells your farts. Okay. So your athletics are also taking off. It was really fun to get to run together on this trip. You discovered the magic of the belly belt, which I didn't really know about until I started coaching. But what are belly belts? How does this work?
Belly belts come in a wide range of options. Uh-huh. I would say, so I went online and I was looking for like, there's like the Recore maternity split and I couldn't find it. It was like sold out. So I bought the like 1970s knockoff version that looks like you're strapping a large bra strap around your stomach to hold your pregnant belly in place.
Yeah.
And it actually really worked.
Yeah, it's kind of like an ace bandage for your midsection. And it really worked, unless you tie it too tight. That's not good.
Yeah, I tied it too tight the first day and I had like a lot of abdominal soreness.
Yeah.
And I got so worried about the health of the baby. I was like, what did I do to baby boy? And of course he's fine. But that did scare me a little bit.
Yeah, getting back into your concerns.
All the different things. Yeah. Actually, my anxieties are getting a little better in pregnancy, but they still sometimes pop up randomly.
Yeah. Well, one thing that you said this weekend, so you ran great in California, you're doing some 6-7 mile runs, is that you were recognizing that you're probably at your athletic peak right now, which is weird because you're going up at the same time from your heart stuff at the same time that pregnancy is changing everything about your body and what you want to do with training in that time. And it's an interesting mindfuck to think about.
It was a curious point of reflection.
Yeah.
I think it's so rare in life that you can recognize that you're at the pinnacle of something. Like I think sometimes with age or like other processes in life, it's always really, it's like more of this, there's a little bit more wiggle room.
Yeah.
Whereas in pregnancy, like the third trimester, it just becomes, I mean, your body is a lot bigger. The hormones are higher. Like second trimester is kind of what I've seen and what I've heard is running bliss. And it's interesting to be able to pinpoint that almost to the exact few weeks and be like, enjoy this now.
Yeah. By running bliss though, it still kind of sucks, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. So, I mean, I was so excited to go back to sea level and I started running uphill and I was like, this does not feel like sea level at all.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm still altitude, which is pregnancy in a nutshell.
Well, you said it a few times on the trip is you were quoting Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, that amazing show, and the song from it, Heavy Boobs, which I think is great. Can I read the lyrics that you sang to me at the
100%. Also, sometimes I substitute legs for boobs
because
they can go hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah. It's more of the metaphorical boobs.
That's
that
true.
Applies during
yes.
pregnancy. It's heavy boobs, dense like dying stars. I got them heavy boobs. They each have their own memoirs.
I know. I've been thinking about what sentence they'd first write for their memoir.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The other lyric that is an option there is instead of they each have their own memoirs, Rachel, the character, says, I can't run real far, which I thought was a little bit messed up because we don't want to, like, obviously everybody can run, but I think in pregnancy, the fundamental shifts make running really, really tough.
It
and
is,
it's going to be a journey.
It's tough. There's a lot of interesting stories and jokes that come from it too. So, but also you've been patient in that process too. Like, I think you've been patient with so many different things. Actually, one one point that comes up is wearing masks. So mm-hmm. because I'm pregnant and immunosuppressed, I have to wear a mask basically everywhere for the next 5 months of pregnancy. And so do you. And you've been amazing with that. Like, you are showing up at races where you're like the only person wearing a mask. And I've just been really impressed with how you've embraced that. Well, but it's not easy.
For yeah. those of us that eschewed, I think that's the word, orthodontic work in our in our early teens, it's a wonderful excuse. I will wear a mask for the rest of my life. I think that there's some straight teeth privilege going on right now for people that don't want to wear masks.
Actually, that's a great point. I had chowed down like this like kale salad at my yeah. conference. And then I just like, you know, sometimes you get worried. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have all this stuff stuck in my teeth. And I didn't care. I just put a mask over it and was like, I'm good to go.
Yeah. I mean, if there's a way I can wear like a full Spider-Man mask around, I would be fine with that. I do not need my face to be shown to the world. Yesterday, when we were at the airport and using Clear, they do this thing where they scan your eyes. And to scan your eyes, you have to have your head a certain amount from this like camera / mirror. And as I was looking at it, I was like, oh my God, that is, my face is gross. My eyebrows need plucking so bad.
I had the exact same realization. I sat there for a moment and I was like, maybe I should exfoliate. I don't even know what exfoliate fully means, but I think my face needs it.
But I, whatever a pore is, my pores are fucked right now. Actually, and as a quick aside, make sure you get Clear if you fly through like Denver Airport consistently.
It's amazing.
Or any airport that has Clear, it changes your life. You can show up at the airport like 20 minutes before your flight, essentially, and get straight through. I'm actually unsure what Clear is and who runs it, because it seems like a scam. It's so good. And I'm like, why does everyone not have this? It is worth everything you could possibly pay. I would pay thousands of dollars for Clear. It is remarkable.
I totally agree. Except it has brought up one point in our relationship yeah. that has been a point of tension and conflict, is that because it's been so efficient, you trust it and you rely on it so heavily
yeah.
that you're like, you know, we have a flight at 1 and you're like, we can leave for the airport at 11:45 and we live 40 minutes away from the airport. And it's been a little horrifying to see that dial like flip further and further and further.
I trust Clear. I actually think, you know, there's all these conspiracy theories out there about like who's running the world and stuff. I think Clear is the Illuminati. Like, I'm not sure how they do it. They have some sort of mechanism in place to control the whole world and do it at a relatively low price. So I'm pretty excited. Okay. So on the California front, lots of big trees there. And this is going to be our transition into some running topics. And I think these big trees have healing powers.
I totally agree. We run in this place called the Forest of Nicene Marks often yes. in Santa Cruz. And you, as soon as you walk into that forest, it feels like you're taking an oxygen bath. Like, it feels like you're at negative sea level.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I mean, if anyone has like a long-term, like they've been feeling bad or anything, and you have the capacity, fly into California, into San Jose Airport, and go to Santa Cruz and go into those trees. I feel like after a few days, it's going to help things in some way. But maybe the best way of all is just like, the approach to the world, when you look up at these trees and you think about, oh, these have been here hundreds of years, thousands in some cases, if you go deep into the old growth redwood forests. And it's such a perspective on life, especially because a lot of these trees have burn marks on them. And I was reading about it online, and a lot of these burns are from many decades ago. And the trees just learned to grow around it. Sometimes they're hollowed out from the fires and still learn to grow around it. And what a good metaphor for, you know, our own setbacks and issues that we face in our lives.
And they're even more beautiful for it. Like, yeah. I actually take pictures of these burn marks often, because it's like, it's distinctive and it's unique in the forest. And it's really fun to see like, just how it creates this like difference amongst the trees. And I love it. And
it's like stretch marks in humans.
So wild right yeah. now talking about this. Like, people are probably like, what are they tripping on? But seriously, if you go to the redwoods and look up, and then bonus points if you hug a tree, because it's truly this like, it really truly is this transformative experience, because they are just so big.
Yeah, they're so big.
They got boob power going on. Yeah. They are so big.
But like,
big honker energy is those trees.
Such big honker energy. But yeah, like I say, I mean, it's like human stretch marks or scars or anything else that we have that, you know, forms us. And I think that that can be, you know, super powerful in thinking about. But as we were running through the trees a couple of days before the race, finished the run. And all of a sudden I had severe ankle pain, kind of like radiating up into my posterior tibial tendon. And I started to panic a little bit. It was rough. I wasn't sure exactly what I should do, because I, you know, I've had ankle issues. My last DNF at a big race, but a long race, was from ankle issues. And I was like, oh no, because I was going with Megan and was going to do a 50K, the Quicksilver 50K on Saturday. and I panicked. And fortunately, I have a doctor right with me that was able to help.
And you asked me to do a very non-doctor, non-scientific thing. You're like, can you perform a chiropractic adjustment on my ankle?
Yeah.
And I was like, David, I have zero experience in chiropractic. And you're like, well, still do it. And I stepped the fuck up.
You did.
And I did it because I was like, every fiber of my being is disagreeing with this right now. This feels dangerous. This feels like not a good idea. And I adjusted the heck out of your ankle.
It did make a big old pop, didn't it?
I like pulled it hard.
Yeah.
It actually scared me, but I was like, let it rip, girl.
Lots of euphemisms there. But fortunately, it gave me more confidence. And so the ankle still hurt at the start. But interestingly, hammering a 50K kind of cured it, which I think is a weird reflection on what happens to the body in these long races and in tapers. Like we've talked about taper niggles before and how they can form and be like debilitating. And then sometimes you race and they go away. But so Quicksilver 50K that I got to do this weekend, it was a monumentally important race for me, I think, in my long-term trajectory. And I didn't really even realize it before I did it. Because for the last few years, I have not done too many of the like bigger races that are out there, mainly because I don't want to race our athletes, especially our pro and elite male athletes, because I don't want them to think that I have a different incentive structure than they do. And I've internalized this to where it became almost an anxiety. And I would panic and look at start lists so much and just figure out races last second. So if you followed my trajectory at all, just in passing, I mean, I've done well at some races, but like you probably have noticed, like I've kind of stopped doing a lot of the really big ones. And this was the first time I really stepped up and went to a race that is a little bit bigger deal. It's an ultra, which is always a big deal for athletes, and raced Chris Myers, who's an amazing swap athlete who's 25, just got signed by Solomon. And it was one of the most fun experiences of my life. And it made me realize that I've been internalizing this anxiety for probably no reason.
Yeah, it's very complicated though. And I mean, I totally get where you come from on that because like you race an athlete, and I hope athletes realize that like our coaching for us is the biggest deal in our life. Like being an athlete is in small, like it's very small comparison to being a coach.
Yeah.
And so like our greatest joy is to coach athletes to beat us in races. Like that's like, you know, that's what we would never like alter an off athlete's training or do anything that would like change that trajectory. But I think it can become challenging when you think about like that incentive process and like how, like, especially too, if it's an athlete that you haven't coached for a long period of time,
yeah,
how challenging that dynamic is. And I was just really proud of how you embrace that. And I think communication is ultimately what it comes down to, is communicating very openly with an athlete that you're racing with and just talking about that and, you know, sharing that up front.
Yeah. And coming in with love. I mean, not the type of love where we're like going to be smelling each other's shirts, but
I hope that love is only reserved for me.
So we talked about it a little bit before the break, Chris and I, and we went out there and he raced so freaking well. And it was one of the coolest things because we ran almost the entire race, like side by side, essentially, or taking turns leading, it was a very hot day and ran very fast times and then finished hand in hand.
Oh,
I've always wanted.
Wait, did you greenlight that with Hidden Pension?
I'm not sure exactly what happened. I did say at one point, like when we were approaching the final climb, like, hey, we stick together here and we can finish together if you'd like, but you can do what he prefers. Because, you know, there's a lot of compromising going on at that point. It's a very hot race. And, you know, I think part of him, he was mentioning some cramps and things. And I think he was like a little, I mean, it's a weird dynamic to be racing your coach.
It's very
right?
weird.
Because
yeah,
like you're getting advice out there, and I wanted to make sure he knew I wasn't going to try to like the usual
like
way,
sprint at the, like, be like, we're going to hold hands and finish and then sprint with 200 meters to
the
go.
The usual way I would have done that, let's say like role play being an asshole, is I would have skipped the last aid station and like sprinted up to the last aid station, knowing that, you know, he's out of water. And that would have not been good for either of us, obviously, but it's also kind of just like how competition works. So it was really nice to do that, to high five across the finish, to have this like ultimate bromance moment. He's an amazing guy. He's going to take over the ultra world upcoming. And yeah, it's very cool, especially in hot weather, which has never been my strong suit.
I was proud of you for stepping up at that because, like, you know, you're going to this race after DNF for an ankle, and you're going into it with ankle pain, and you stepped into the unknown, being willing just to embrace whatever came in a situation which you were already uncomfortable because your athlete was racing, and you did it with love and swag and badassery.
So how about I go into some like training life takeaways from
Boom.
This?
Boom, let's do it.
Awesome. So the first is, I talked last week about how it was going to be hot, and it did get hot. It was in the mid 80s in high sun, which for me is like not good for my penguin soul. It is not good at all. I was very, 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 very concerned about cramps and having issues. So the first thing that I focused on was hydration out there. And so this, my big message to people that might underperform at longer races, particularly marathons and ultras, is think about, are you a heavy sweater? Or especially, are you a heavy salter in your sweat? But for me out there, I had 36 to 44 ounces of fluid per hour.
That's wild. That's actually way over what I typically recommend to athletes. And when I heard that you did that, I was actually, well, when I was, I don't know, I was deeply proud of you because that's not something you usually do. You don't usually take the time to stop at aid stations to do that. And so I was proud of you for investing in your health and performance, but also I was impressed. I was impressed that you stomached that and, you know, took that down.
Yeah. I mean, I found that athletes often need that if they're heavy sweaters like I am. And so what I did is I had an 18 ounce handheld, Nathan handheld. And then, so I would drink it between aid stations, and there were a lot of aid stations on the course. And then later in the race, Chris, it was great to run with Chris because we would drink a bottle at the aid station and then fill the bottle. And it really provided a good, you know, if we were like absolutely racing each other balls to the wall at that point, it might not balls to the wall. That is a very strange phrase when
that
you say
it. That is such a strange phrase. I feel like we should get rid of that phrase as a society. Yeah, it's weird.
Boobs to the wall, ovaries to the wall.
Honkers to the wall.
Honkers to the wall. Let's change it. But so it was nice to not be racing each other purely. But I think that this might be a key metric in fatigue resistance more generally. So we talk about how fatigue resistance varies so much athlete to athlete. And one thing I've seen is some of the athletes with outstanding fatigue resistance, let's say Claire Gallagher, Drew Holman, people like that, don't seem to sweat very much, at least in terms of how much fluid they need.
Actually, I would caveat that. Yeah. I don't know if it's that they don't sweat very much. I think you can be an efficient sweater, and that's what the sauna helps you train to do. So if you have gone to the sauna for a prolonged period of time, you actually start sweating earlier because your body is more efficient at cooling, but it's the concentration of the sweat. So you're not sweating, the sweat that you're sweating is more dilute. And so you're not losing as much electrolytes and salt in that process.
It probably depends heavily. I mean, what I'd love to see is more readily available sweat tests that we can do everywhere in the country. I mean, there's some good places in the Front Range of Boulder in the Bay Area. But one place I might start to invest more as a coach is getting athletes to do sweat tests that give us much more, concrete information on what they need and to replace. Because I mean, 44 ounces an hour, if I told an athlete to do that, I would panic because I'd be
me
like,
too. I'd be
they're
like,
gonna
is that
die
over?
Out there.
Yeah.
And if anything, that was low for me. I probably would have done better to have even more at the end. Because I, you know, didn't even like, there's one place where I could have drank a little bit more. And it points out that this is an opportunity. Second one on hydration is after you get to the finish line at these races, I like athletes to recover like they have to do a drug test. So when you have to do a drug test, you have to pee into a cup. And often after a race, you're not ready to pee yet. And so I like athletes just hydrate like they have to pee into a cup as quickly as possible. Not just with water, like make sure it has electrolytes. But I found that really accelerates your recovery process and prevents some of the like muscle damage issues that athletes sometimes complain about.
I was surprised. So I dropped you off at the race and I saw the first little bit go off and I had to go off to my conference.
Yeah.
And so you Ubered to campus. I came back and saw you. And usually when I see you post race, you look like a carcass of a human. Like you're just like this walking zombie. Like you have been through some stuff.
Yeah.
And basically anyone who walks by you would know that immediately.
Yeah.
And you look totally normal and chill after this race. And I think that's probably a broader reflection on this fueling and hydration approach.
Yeah. So we talked about fueling in past episodes. I think hydration is the other element to really emphasize. Try different things, be careful, but go for it. The next one is heat. So we talked about how I was going to use the sauna. I think it actually worked pretty darn well out there. But the other thing I was thinking about doing the heat is like, oh, I'm going to monitor my heart rate a little bit. And so I like mile five, I glanced down at my heart rate expecting to see like 155 or 160, something really sustainable. And I saw 170, which is getting dangerously close to my lactate threshold. It might even be around it. And I was like, okay, not going to look at heart rate again. I'm just going to imagine that I didn't see that. And fortunately, it worked out for me, probably because sea level heart rate is more elevated than altitude heart rate. But it's one of those lessons of use metrics wisely in races. Don't invest yourself fully in them. Because if I had tried to run by heart rate in that race, I wouldn't have gotten to run faster.
I actually tell athletes almost to never look at heart rate during races. I think for a few things. One, tapering can actually make heart rate higher, which is a good thing. It makes it more jumpy and more responsive. But that can often freak out athletes when you see that in the middle of the race. Caffeine, nerves, excitement, all of these different factors feed into that and often make for an elevated heart rate. And so I tell athletes, don't really worry about it.
I mean,
go by feel. I mean, sometimes like if you glance at it and you know you're the type of person that can handle that data, totally fine. But I think basing an entire race off it is really not helpful or productive.
Definitely. And I wonder if like in 100 milers, it might be more effective, but I guess that really depends. You probably have to have your zones totally dialed for those exact conditions with that exact taper, because my heart rate got super jumpy on race day. And it was clearly very sustainable because I got to the finish feeling really good and could have kept going, which is rare for me. Though if I saw my average heart rate in that race, it was as high as a half marathon I do at like higher altitude. And so I would have thought it wasn't sustainable. It's a really tough problem to think about. And to think about how physiology fundamentally changes in the taper, especially the well-designed taper, like the one Coach Megan gave to me. A little aside there is saunas. We mentioned this a lot in terms of heat acclimation. I wrote an article on the science of it the other week. I think it's a little complicated right now with COVID everywhere.
It is, actually. I kind of struggle with that as a coach because COVID rates are drastically increasing across the country. Unfortunately, with Omicron, it's from what we've seen in SWAT, they've been pretty mild cases. Athletes coming back, returning well, doing strong in training. But if you have a key race coming up, you actually really, it would be great not to get COVID just from the perspective of like not having to adjust training, of, you know, being confident going into that race. And also just the good thing to avoid COVID if you can, in terms of like spreading it to family members or other logistics. But we've been telling athletes to wear, and this sounds a little bit like David Goggins-esque, wear a KN95 in the sauna.
Yeah.
It really enhances the experience and it helps prevent COVID.
So especially to our Western States athletes out there that are listening this year, please wear a mask in the sauna. Like, it is not worth it. If you get COVID right now, your Western States is not going to be as good as it could be. And why not wear a mask? Like, the sauna probably has 100% transmission rate if you step in there with someone that has COVID. And it's a big risk, I think.
I'd actually be curious to know, and we should do research on this, on like the transmission dynamics in a sauna, whether that like escalates transmission or whether the heat, I don't know. I'm trying to like think through that rationally, which is really hard to do when you're talking into a microphone, but I'd be curious to know, and we can maybe do some research and get back to people on that.
Well, yeah, my guess is it activates the chlamydia on the benches, but I'm not sure about COVID. I don't know as much about COVID. Why do I know a lot about chlamydia in this hypothetical? I'm not exactly sure. Probably shouldn't go in there too long. The next one is related to what we've talked about in recent episodes, which is fueling. So I think the big place I made a difference, I've been good about fueling during races, but was the day before. I really tried to up my overall intake, especially of carbs. And the main way I did it, so at dinner we ate like a lentil pasta.
Actually,
which was
a lot of pasta.
A lot of pasta. But then right before bed, I was like, hey, Megan, should I eat more? And she's like, yes. And so I downed some peanut butter puffins, which I think are the magic performance food. So peanut butter puffins is my official carb loading recommendation. I went and probably ate half a box and I felt so good the next day. I had no issues with bonking or fatigue the entire race. It was wonderful.
It was the first time that I've seen you do a concentrated carbohydrate focus. And I was all about it. Actually, I joined you. I was not doing anything. In fact, I took a rest day the next day and I joined you. It was great.
Well,
I felt my brain was extra activated for thinking at this conference, despite the fact of not moving.
You're creating life though, which is a big job.
That's true. Baby boy had some extra carbs on board.
Yeah.
He loved it. He was, you know, there for you. He was following the same process as dad.
Just a role model already. But actually, it reminds me of Way Too Cool in 2016, which was maybe my breakthrough ultra at the time. I did the same thing by accident because we got to the hotel and like I was just nervous and I ate an entire box of puffins and it went great. So maybe the lesson here is that puffins are EPO. Like, that's the secret all along.
It probably counteracts the, like, you've had amazing, like, heat resistance and, heat, like, you know, like, prevention of, like, heat fatigue. And maybe you're just, like, channeling your inner swag puffin.
Big puffin energy.
Big puffin energy. But puffins are in cold, so they're...
Well, they're kind of like penguins, so maybe
You're giving homage to your penguin DNA.
Yeah.
And so as a result, you're expressing the other heat shock proteins that you have.
It's like the Lion King when he looks up at the sky and he's, like, pointing out his ancestors. That's me looking at the puppets.
Exactly.
You know, it was a really joyous experience all around. A final little reflection on training is related to the taper. I think Coach Megan really nailed this one. The big things that elements that she had, the first was my last big workout was 11 days before, which was the Hill Beast, which was 10, 8, 6, 4, 2 minute steep hills with run back recovery. It really prepared me. I got to the point in that race where I was like, nothing can break me because the Hill Beast didn't, which I think is a good place to be.
I've been giving athletes a few more Hill Beasts in their training. They may recognize that. Actually, sometimes they even do 8, 6, 4, 2, depending upon where they are in their training volume. And I still call that the Hill Beast.
Yeah.
It's technically the Hill Beast light, but it's still very beastly. And I think it's a key training. We give that to a lot of our athletes. And 11 days out is kind of that like prime time for it.
Yeah, 10 or 11 or something like that. And the final reflection, I think, is on how downhill resilience plays a role in these long runs. Check out my article in Trail Runner magazine today. It's on the science of downhill running. It's like 4,000 words. Why the fuck can't I help myself? I was planning on writing like a 500 or 600 word article yesterday. And then all of a sudden I'm like, Megan, there's so many footnotes. What happened?
Actually, I opened it up and I saw that it was 6 pages long. And I was like, he had a party. But I get it. It's very similar to us being like, we are going to record an hour podcast. Yeah. Then it's an hour 20 or an hour 30, inevitably.
Yeah, it always happens. So focusing on your downhill resilience a little bit in the weeks before your race, I did a lot of faster downhills than I would usually do. And I think it really paid off on race day because the uphills are just speed. The subsequent uphills after those first uphills are about how your body is able to handle the cumulative fatigue. Much of that comes from downhills, as the article gets into. Well, she should talk about the science of downhill running on a future episode. What do you think?
I think it's pretty key. It's also key to subsequent performance on uphills.
Yeah.
So it's downhills with an asterisk because it actually applies after the first downhill, the rest of the race becomes dependent upon your ability to handle that first downhill. So it's downhill and other things.
Yeah. It's essentially controlling the rate of decay.
Exactly.
I can always run downhill fast. The question is, how is my body going to respond to it? And, in the past, I always be like, oh, I guess I'm bad at uphills at the end of races. It's like, no, actually, you're just not prepared enough for downhills and you're probably underhydrating. So final thing, hell yeah, to everyone out there that was at the race, we love you so much. I got so many woohoos on the course and people saying, love the podcast. It was one of the cooler experiences of my whole life. It really kept me out of my own head. So thank you. Love you all. That was amazing.
It's really cool to go to races now because we get to talk and engage with so many podcast listeners. It's like, it's actually great. And deep apologies. So I stood 100 feet from the start line as people were coming in. It was so fun to see the whole race pass. Deep apologies for when I said almost there. It was kind of the first thing that came out of my brain, but I got a lot of laughs out of it. So I think it was worth it.
Were you saying that the whole time people were coming up?
Yeah.
Almost there.
Everyone laughed. It was a good crowd.
Okay. Yeah. It's like in comedy, they say that, the crowd is what determines the success of a set. You just had a really good crowd that was willing to laugh.
I felt the crowd energy and I was like, these are our people.
I like it. Yeah.
Joke making time.
Perfect. Okay. So we have some other fun training topics that we'll get into in a future week, but we have something much more important, which is some TV show recommendations.
We have been watching TV quite a bit. It's been fun. Yeah. It's actually our way to unwind at night. Like, we both have pretty busy, jam-packed work days. And then I so look forward to that hour where I get to watch a TV show for 45 minutes and fall asleep on the couch for 15. Yeah. And it's great.
Pregnancy gives you another excuse for your nap game that just you go out like a light. You probably don't know what happened at the end of any of these shows.
Well, it's kind of a tragedy because it's whenever anything gets really interesting, I feel like that's the point that we've been we sit there for 30, 45 minutes, we invest in it, and then I'm just out cold.
Well, and it's always the most intense part of the show. Like, I'm like, oh my God, my heart rate's 120. I'm so nervous. And Megan just a little
piggy. Hey, I actually don't snore.
Yeah, you do?
No, hardly at all.
You totally snore.
Okay, well, you snore really loud. I snore soft in comparison.
Okay, no, actually, you don't snore. You sometimes make, as you start to fall asleep, you make a sound for a second.
I know when I make it. It's like a hmm sound like that.
It's really cute.
And sometimes I shake all my limbs. Sometimes.
You do. I'm projecting onto you. Actually, my biggest sleep issue. So we've talked before about how I sometimes make noise. We've learned from Whoop that it's in my deep sleep that I'll sometimes go, have the sleep apnea sounding noises. Where it's the worst though is in naps. Every single nap I hit deep sleep. And as soon as I do, I start sounding like a runaway freight train, according to Megan. And it makes sense because sometimes I'll wake myself up with it from the nap. It's not good.
It's wild. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I'm going to say this. I'm feeling empowered. You know, sometimes post-sex, you really enjoy taking naps.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, I just you feel really satisfied with that bang because you fall asleep in 60 seconds and then you're making that noise. And it's actually very cute. I've come to love it. But at first I was like, did I just kill him? What happened?
Oh, that would be a good epitaph. Good obituary in the Boulder Daily Camera. Yeah, while we're on this topic, might as well say, so the day after the race, I was really sore. But most sore was my left hip, which, I've had issues with in the past. And I basically lost the ability to lift it, from my knee. If you're lifting your leg out of the car, it was excruciating, but also just had no power.
Well, also, side note here, and I'm saying this with utmost love as a wife, is that we have very different reactions to pain.
Yeah.
So when you're in pain, you just decide to not bear weight at all on that affected joint. So it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's your ankle or your hip or your, I don't know what. And you're just you act like your leg is totally non-functional on that side. So that's what you're doing. I caught you hiking post-race with a totally non-functional looking leg.
But yeah, okay, so it was non-functional. It wasn't just non-functional looking. And that afternoon, you know, it's a vacation to the cabin. So, you know, whatever stuff happens. But during, while stuff was happening, all of a sudden there was just a loud and my hip pain went away. So talking about chiropractic adjustments, you are a healer.
I'm a doctor. Well, actually, it's a good thing. I had no idea that happened.
Okay.
I think I would have been so horrified by that experience and by this like chiropractic accidental adjustment that I would have been so taken out of the moment. You told me like 20 minutes later and I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was one of the weirder experiences of my life. It went from purely excruciating to so much better. And then the next day, totally fine. And I am flabbergasted and wondering if, like, actually, this is the best part about having your wife as your coach. Like, people are often like, oh, isn't it hard to have your coach as your partner? And I'm like, actually, there are benefits that are not talked about publicly. And the main one is chiropractic adjustments for hips.
The next time anything hurts on your body and you're walking with like a totally non-functional leg, you're going to be like, Megan, your services are in need.
Yeah. What are you going to do with my foot? If that's it, I think hip makes more sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure we can figure something out by proxy.
We can probably Google it.
Yes.
I'm sure there's something out there. Okay. Back to TV shows. That was quite an aside. The first one is The Dropout on Hulu. This is about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. It is freaking awesome. It is very entertaining. It is surprisingly like funny. Really enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it. I also had a side of anxiety with it.
Uh-huh.
I feel like whenever I hear about Theranos, I just like, I gravitate towards whatever I have done wrong in life, which feels like the littlest things. I'm like, oh my gosh, am I going to jail for like, I can't even think like turning in a homework assignment late or something like that. And I definitely did not sleep very well at night after watching that, just kind of like relaying everything I could have potentially done wrong in life.
Yeah, I think generally people that don't like cheat, lie, and steal always see cheat, liars, and stealers and then are like, what the fuck am I doing with my life? I'm messing everything
That's
up.
That's true. That makes me feel a little better.
Yeah. But, I mean, I felt the same way. Like watching that, you're just constantly worried. It's like, oh my God, I sure I didn't pay house insurance and our house is going to be repossessed or whatever. It's like some wild thing or, you know, just every single little anxiety you can. But that being said, great show. Very interesting. The Dropout. The next one is Sex Lives of College Girls on HBO Max. Way good. I have never heard of it, though people really like it. I think it's good for, I think basically anyone would love this show.
It is so good. I have to admit the name is a little bit of false advertising. Yeah. So we were scrolling through and I was like, let's watch that one. That looks great. There's not as much of that as you would expect based off of the fact that it's included in the title.
Yeah.
But it was so good. Like I felt like young, actually, I mean, like we are like, I don't know, 10 years older than all these characters, but I felt so deeply invested in their journeys, in like in their personal lives. And it almost like took me back to college where I would like finish this like really engaging book series or even like being a young girl and feeling this like weight of loss when it was done. Like I was just so invested and so sad when it was done. So I'm already looking forward to the next season.
Well, I'm 15 years older than any of the characters in that show. So speak for yourself. It was created by Mindy Kaling, who is incredible. She has an amazing biography. You should read that as well. Next one, similar to Dropout, Dope Sick on Hulu as well. It's got recommended to us by a podcast listener. It's remarkable. It's on the opioid crisis, which had led me not to watch it for a really long time because it's like, oh, this can be a little too heavy and a little too dark. It's actually told in a really interesting and captivating way, though it does have some dark moments. I mean, it's just a very dark topic. But even knowing about the opioid crisis via documentaries and reading a lot of things, I think I learned a lot and gained a lot of empathy from this show.
And what I really liked was they told it from multiple perspectives too. So they told it from the perspectives of people being addicted, from doctors prescribing it, from pharma, from lawyers. And I think there's something about like the constantly changing frame of perspective that I love and grasp onto. I think it's because I love like chaotic lives and chaotic stories. So there's something like constantly like ever changing about that show, like something totally new. But I mean, it made me think about addiction quite a bit. Like I think anytime that you work in medicine, you see addiction almost actually, unfortunately, like daily in practice. And it made me really think about the weight of addiction. And this was specifically about OxyContin, which is an opiate, but I think they could easily do fentanyl as well. And I think they should almost do a follow-up on fentanyl and what's happening with fentanyl in the United States. But it was an interesting reflection.
And just how addiction is so intertwined with so many things that are chemical in our brains, right? That these chemical processes happen, our brains remodel through the chemical processes. So the decisions we make might not even be like of our own volition. And we should give so much compassion to people that might make decisions we wouldn't, because they're not making that decision in the same context we are. It's with a very different, brain structure. And so I think Dope Sick really added to, my compassion in that regard.
It also, it made me think about, it was actually when I was in med school, I had these like two competing like paths that I was interested in. So one was orthopedic surgery, which I like quickly decided is like, that's not really the lifestyle or like the culture that I'm looking for. And the other was community medicine. So I was on like both ends of the spectrum in terms of what I was interested in. But I think one of the big challenges for me in community medicine was thinking about having to prescribe some of this stuff. And what I thought was, I found fascinating when I was in medicine was some doctors just step off that prescribing train altogether. Yeah. So I worked with doctors like, you know, internal medicine, family medicine, doctors, pediatric doctors that were just like, we just don't prescribe this. Yeah. And, you know, taking that step back. But even if you take that step back, you still work with patients who are addicted to this. And, you know, even like it can impact your ratings. Like there's so many different ways that it's intertwined into the medical
and
some system.
And patients that have terrible chronic pain. And, you know, this is addressing a problem, and the problem doesn't go away when you stop addressing it. It just gets, it stays there. And so it's a big issue. And, yeah, it's really interesting. That being said, you said there were multiple stories being told at the same time. There was one story we just fully skipped. So if you've watched,
that's true.
There's this story of a divorce happening essentially.
It was awkward.
It was just like, I don't need it. And the show still worked. So you can skip if there's any like of the particular vignettes you don't want to follow throughout the show.
Actually, this gives it a point of conflict. We talked about 2 points of conflict. A point of conflict in our relationship is that sometimes you like to skip through awkward moments on shows. And I'm like, what are you doing? This is fundamental to the story's progress. And you're like, nope, can't do it. Too awkward. And so you fast forward like 5 minutes later. And I have a problem with that.
Well, I think whatever personality trait makes you smell my wafting BO also makes you smell the like human BO on this show of like an unnecessarily divorce of like a lawyer that we don't need to get into. Okay, next one, incredible, brilliant show called Severance on Apple TV. Basically Severance was one of the more like mind-bending shows I've seen in a long time.
It was captivating.
If you liked Lost back in the day, it has a very Lost vibe, but you're in better hands. Like it seems like the creators know what they're doing with it. Whereas in Lost, they were just throwing shit at the wall randomly, like a bunch of drunk monkeys. So Severance, absolutely amazing. It's about essentially how so much of our lives is in this cookie cutter manner, whether it's at work or other places, and how much we're actually in control of and where the offsets lie. That's basically all I can say without giving anything away, but it is remarkable. Just the first episode's a little slow and then it picks up.
It made me think a lot and think a lot about a lot of things. But interesting thing about Severance though, is that it's great for a date.
Yes.
So it moves pretty slowly. And I actually found like, usually I like fast paced moving shows, but I found a lot of peace and there was art in how it was moving slowly, but it also gave us time to make jokes and talk.
Yes.
And so I feel like if you're looking for a sexy date, even though Severance isn't like a sexy topic, you can have very engaging discussions while watching it.
I totally agree. Yeah, I think it wouldn't be the that makes sense. It wouldn't be the show I would love to watch alone, probably, for that regard, because like we spent so much time just ragging on the characters. I wish we had recorded that for a podcast.
We've been thinking about like different podcast structures. It'd be really fun just to like live do a show.
We should
live podcast a show.
We should live broadcast a race.
That
would be super fun.
That'd be very fun.
Do like a YouTube live or something. The next one, we love watching bike racing. We've been watching the Giro d'Italia recently, which is the Tour of Italy. In case you want to hear my amazing Italian. And it's kind of amazing. But again, Megan always falls asleep before the finish. So you have no idea what's going on.
Like fail safe. They get 10 kilometers from the finish and I'm just out cold.
Yeah.
And the like final sprint is the most exciting part of bike racing. Though it's also kind of also a good date thing to watch because you can just chat as you're watching the bikers. You get to see beautiful scenery. Like it's relaxing and peaceful. And I feel like would pair well with a glass of wine. but yeah, I'm always asleep by the end.
So that's great. And then the final thing, this is on the outline a while ago. We never got to it. Was we watched the NFL draft. And the main reason I wanted to bring this up is because the NFL draft, as they're scouting these prospects, they use a bunch of terminology, a vocabulary that they use over and over again to describe players. And we wanted to mention some of them because they are fucking hilarious.
Actually, before you mention this, we should highlight the fact that we watched all 3 rounds of the NFL draft. I got very invested into these stories.
Yeah.
You get to see highlight clips of the players. Like, I personally love watching shows, sports, like any sort of event where you can see people like in real time get to celebrate and just like enjoy this moment. And it was so fun to see like the family celebrations, like the team celebrations, all of that. So it was cool.
If you had told 12-year-old me that I would sit down and watch the first 3 rounds in the NFL draft with my sexy pregnant wife, I would have said, this is not real. Okay. You are fucking with me. Stop. That is my ultimate dream. Okay. So the first two are Wiggly And then oily hips. So both are used, wiggly and oily hips, to describe someone that has a lot of agility, that's good with side-to-side movement. So perhaps that's why my hip got adjusted. You are good and wiggly.
I feel like wiggly could be a descriptor for many things.
Yes.
Like a human body can do. Like, I feel especially wiggly right now in the current state I'm in. So I jive with that.
Yeah. You do have some wiggles. I like it. Number, I guess, three is bubble. So this is, I'm going to read from an article that was in Defector by Kaylin Kaler. Bubble is how scouts describe a prospect's glutes. This is a good term. And yes, scouts regularly say the term bubble in a draft meeting, as in bubble butt. It means that it's really toned. It's really large.
Can you imagine saying the term bubble butt in a draft meeting? Like,
yeah.
I feel like all in every single meeting I'm in, that would probably get me fired.
Yeah, but quite a big fan. Also very weird how we're talking about these prospects. The reverse of a bubble butt is a wood toter's ass. It means a flat ass, which is not a good thing in this world. And yeah, it's just really, really weird to think about these bodies being judged in this manner. And next one is good ball skills. Another that has multiple meanings and is quite interesting. Unmade waterbed.
Okay, I'm trying to think about what that means. How can you break that down for me a little bit?
So you know, like an unmade waterbed, it kind of gets back to like
it's just kind of
yeah.
It's just, I was going to use an adjective, and I was like, that's not appropriate.
Yeah, I think we're venturing into problematic waters here. So
well, that's the whole point. We're going to get back to that in a second. But yeah, let's not actually let's take a step back. Let's just leave it as it's.
Okay,
not fully describe it.
We're all getting to this for a reason. I promise. The next is their small hands. So they talk about their hand size a lot, and it's been actually a fascinating story. So Kenny Pickett, the quarterback from Pittsburgh, measured with some of the smallest hands in draft history for a quarterback this year. So he had his hands talked about constantly. He still got picked relatively early, but it's one of those ways of like people thinking about how we measure things, changing then how we conceive of evaluation processes. Hand size has been shown to have no correlation with performance in the NFL, yet it has constantly knocked down athletes' draft stock if their hand is like a half inch too small. And it's like, that's exactly how athletes and runners think about themselves when it comes to like, I don't know, endurance.
VO2 max. That was perfect what I was thinking of. Actually, VO2 max is way more directly related to performance and hand size. But I'm trying to think of something even like, I feel like foot size. Like, have you heard people say that like larger feet, it's going to be harder to become nimble on trails, which is like totally not true, but I could see the same analogy there.
I've heard them say other things about foot size. okay. We're going to move on from that and get to why
I think the reason that we brought that up is as we were going through the NFL draft and seeing players described this way, I was curious by it because it's like, I think how we talk about bodies can become very problematic.
Yeah.
And I think in this situation, perhaps it's a little bit different because these are like specimens of a human that we're paying multi-million dollar contracts. But I think at the same time, there's a lot baked into there historically into how we talk about bodies in general. And I think it's a way that we need to like reframe as a culture and society, no matter what gender we're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, I think if you talked about women in this way, you would get immediately fired from broadcast, yet it's okay to talk about a big beefy quarterback this way. And I'm kind of fascinated by that dichotomy there and why, I mean, I understand like why it exists, but I think I'll be interested to see where that goes in the future.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's got to change
for
a number of different reasons. I mean, I think a significant word you used there was specimen. Which is a word that they use a lot in the NFL draft. It's like, that is a pure objectifying word of these,
humans. Yes, exactly. Yeah, I recognize that, yeah.
And, you know, that is a problem.
What's a dehumanizing word?
Yeah, to a certain extent. And it just gets back to how we think about bodies in general. And so the reason we're bringing this up is to try not to think of your body like you're doing an NFL draft analysis. And as we've seen, those analyses have no correlation with like performance. Tom Brady was not picked because of the way until the sixth round because of the way his body looked, and he turns into the best player of all time. It is people drawing correlations that don't exist, trying to exert on control on an uncontrollable process, much like a lot of us do about our own bodies. So in that context, we're going to be talking about semaglutide, a thing I heard about recently that I had never known about, that is used essentially as a drug to reduce people's weight. And it's seen these wild results in clinical trials. And I think it has a lot of interesting metaphors for how we think about our own bodies.
And we actually had a little bit of a debate when we brought up, you brought this up and you're like, I really want to do this discussion. And I was troubled by it because I think I've been in the medical world long enough to understand that like weight-based specific medication interventions are often fraught with side effects and fraught with issues. And, but I think this actually does a great job at conveying larger points. And so I think it's helpful to talk about.
So what do you know about semaglutide?
So semaglutide has largely been used as a diabetes medication in medicine. It works as a glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist, which is a big word.
Yeah.
But basically, when you break that down, semaglutide is responsible for increasing the production of insulin, which then is a hormone that lowers the blood sugar level. And what they were seeing in the diabetes patients was that this was decreasing hunger and cravings and also feelings of anxiety around food. And so it was starting to be used in patients with obesity and starting to be trialed in more of these populations. And that's kind of the studies that we are going to get into, but it's not about those studies. It's not about the medication. It's about how we talk about bodies and the chemical composition that makes all of our bodies and cravings and
brains.
Feelings and brains and everything that goes into who we are different.
Yeah. What I was so shocked by and why I ended up wanting to talk about this is it was motivated by seeing tweet threads from doctors saying that this medication fundamentally altered people's lives. Like people that were one of the quotes I saw said 600 pounds, where suddenly they weren't consumed with anxiety around food. And it shows that there must have been some chemical cause of this initial thing. And I was just fascinated. It's like, how have I never heard about this thing that is doctors are talking about this way? Obviously, it's going to get way more complicated than that. But I just thought it was really fascinating.
But before we dive into that, I've been recently loving like long form articles. And
yeah.
The Plain is a great place to read long form articles. And I actually read a long form article that had some great quotes in it that I think really ties in well to this discussion about the broader sense of weight and bodies and weight loss. And this is in the New York Times by Sam Anderson. It's called, "I've Always Struggled with My Weight. Losing it didn't mean winning." And so the context here is that Sam, he lost weight using Noom. And in that process of losing weight, it made him think about diet culture and bodies in comparison, especially because his father was thin. And that was often someone that he compared himself to and often struggled in that comparison. And what he ultimately found, and this is what he conveyed at the end of the article, and this is the quote that I'm about to read, was that the elements of what he called that made him an overeater was this voracity for life that like really paralleled the enthusiasm. He had this like unbridled enthusiasm that he loved about himself.
Yeah.
And that was also reflected in his behavior with food, and that he recognized that like he would not be who he was if he didn't have that unbridled enthusiasm. And I thought it was really beautiful, like seeing him untangle all of that.
Yeah. And it gets back to how all of the things that our brains are so intertwined with every element. So like when we talked about addiction earlier, most people that might be prone to addiction are often like high achievers in other parts of their lives. And there's a reason that those are connected. The problem is, how do you separate what's serving you and what's not? And the point is like, you know, when it comes to especially bodies, we've been served this plate by society that some things are maybe more worthwhile or good than others. And that judgment on our bodies does not apply. Like there's so much freaking value judgments being made that are not relevant. Like health happens at any size. And I think that that's really, really important. And also this article is so beautiful. And I mean, I would love if you read some quotes from
it. Yeah, and often those bodily changes don't change the underlying person of who you are. And that's what Sam grappled with. And this is what he wrote. "I had been thinking in those days a lot about bodies. At the end of his life, my father was very ill. I thought about the way my able body had allowed me to help his suddenly disabled body with its basic functions, just as he helped me with those same functions 40 years before. He could hardly swallow in the end, and he had been so skinny, and I felt so close to him. Life can be so sad. I thought a lot, of course, about the terrible fact that my father's body was now in the ground, and that his body was an object, and that my body, too, would someday be only an object. The crisis of my father's body made me think, in a new way, about the basic crisis of every human body. That we will always, in the end, be disabled, lose control. In many ways, this is what our bodies are, ever-present reminders of our essential lack of control. The body subjects us to gravity and pain. It makes us eat, sleep, fall, sit. It is the only part of us that can be bitten by a dog or go tumbling down a flight of stairs. Much of diet culture is a sublimated response to this crisis, an attempt to discipline the unruliness of the body, to transcend it, to prove that we are not, in the end, merely things. Diet culture is a fear of death, disguised as transformation. But the transformation is a fantasy. If, through some heroic act of will, you do manage to heave yourself into a new place, it is you who did the heaving. It is you who stands in the new place. You will still be you. And I will still be Fat Sam. I will also be the person who is embarrassed by Fat Sam. My feelings about my body form a chord of many notes, not all of which sound good together. I am, all at once, the one who wants to swallow the world, and the one responsible for stopping myself from swallowing the world. This probably means that I will always be unsatisfied in some way until the moment that everything ends. And I will have to learn to be satisfied with this.
Wow. That is one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. And I'm going to finish up the article because I love this last paragraph. For now, every morning, I wake up and try to direct Fat Sam within certain reasonable boundaries. I make him a large bowl of Greek yogurt with green grapes and chopped fruits and 10 almonds. He eats it ravenously with hilarious joy. Together, Fat Sam and I think about the yogurt for the rest of the day, and we go to bed still thinking about it, excited to head down to the kitchen and eat it all again.
Isn't that, I read that on the airport and on the airplane and was just captivated by his writing. I think the idea of like diet culture and restriction as a way to control the unruliness of the body. Like I see that so often from people trying to lose weight to people with eating disorders. And I think it's, I don't know, I'm fascinated to think about that connection and the fact that, as he pointed out, like our bodies are all unruly and that trying to control it is a process that will just inevitably break down.
Yeah. And the way that he talks about the zest for life that is directly tied to it. And it's why when we're talking about bodies, we're always like, find your strong, that, you know, eat enough, enjoy your life, be, you know, be active. And what results from that is perfect as it is. And I think that that is kind of what he's pointing out there, that you are enough as you are. And that that strong element will look like a lot of different things. And, you know, directing it into reasonable boundaries is different than like exerting control over the inevitability of death.
And one other thing I think about is the idea that we've crafted this like find your strong message, and certainly a lot of other people have too. And I think it's empowering to see society like trending in that direction. But I think for me, that was something I learned through the practice of coaching and working with athletes as opposed to the practice of medicine.
Yeah.
And I look back on that with curiosity because, you know, I graduated medical school like what, 4.5 years ago?
Yeah, not long ago.
Not long ago. And we received, I mean, Stanford had amazing medical education. I look back and I was really grateful for all that I learned. But we actually never learned how to talk to patients about weight, about body size, about these things. And I think it's a fundamental part of communicating to patients, yet many doctors don't have training in it. And I think often people go to like primary care practitioners or other people and they feel like dismayed by how they're like practitioner communicates weight. And I think it's really important, like if you feel that way, just openly like have that conversation with your doctor about how you want it to be communicated, because so many people also just aren't trained in this or don't even contextualize this or think about this in the way that I think society is more pushing towards.
Yeah. And that's such an interesting reflection. And I mean, for me, it was like, you know, having my own experiences with thinking I needed to look a certain way. And as soon as I dropped that, life got so much better. And like that joy for life was allowed to come back. But I still struggle talking about it sometimes, which is why we're kind of walking a tightrope here, trying to say, hey, a lot of these things are, you know, actually kind of like somewhat controllable and within reasonable bounds, and that can be healthy, but also you're perfect the way you are. And that I think is the hard part of medications like semaglutide. So here's one of the tweets that I heard. Patients with obesity often describe finally feeling, quote, normal when given this medication. They are finally not ravenous and thinking about eating all the time. Another response to that. And these are from doctors. I had two patients just yesterday make the same exact comment, showing how changing levels of a natural gut peptide can be a game changer, similar to altering brain chemistry with SSRIs for depression. Patients finally feel some element of control when before they felt uncontrollable, which again, gets to the complicated part that he was mentioning, that is that control a positive thing or a negative thing? And so there are a bunch of trials on studies on this in New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, other places that essentially found like 15% weight loss for people that had, you know, very, very high levels of obesity across the board compared to 2% with placebo, which is pretty remarkable, especially when you consider that those changes are not mechanistically happening due to like changed metabolism. They're happening due to a change with how gut peptides affect how the brain considers this process. And it's kind of shocking to think about, okay, our brain is so like variable in, among people. And to me, it just, it's not, it just gives me so much compassion because a follow-up study on 1900 patients found that when they went off, they regained most of the weight. So, you know, we are who we are, and that can be a really beautiful thing. And I don't know, how do you operate in that liminal space between loving who you are and, you know, having things like whether it's addiction or, you know, ravenous hunger or other elements that might feel a little uncontrolled.
Well, I really appreciate you highlighting that compassion over the study results element of it, because I think to me, the 15%, yes, it's actually shocking and staggering, yeah. and it's a cool thing to see. But I think if you go off the medication, you often gain that back, which is challenging. And I also think too, there's so many side effects. Like if you're reading these, like diarrhea, nausea, like all different kinds of things can happen when you take a medication. And so I'm a little bit more of a medication skeptic, but I think to me, the whole crux of this is the comparison of gut peptides to brain chemistry and what happens when you take an SSRI. Because I think as a society, we're becoming more comfortable talking about brain chemistry and yeah. the fact that everyone has different brain chemistry. And sometimes that needs to be altered. And I think we haven't quite made that extension to talking about gut peptides in the same way.
Microbiome.
Or any of these different concepts that make us who we are and that affect our decisions, that affect our behavior. And I felt like that opened my eyes for me. And I really appreciated it's not about the medication, but it's about the medication itself opening our eyes to these pathways.
Yeah. And I think whatever you means, is something far greater than what you look like or what your body does or how, or anything like that. And so the ultimate message is to give yourself so much love, including for the things that you might struggle with sometimes, the things that do feel out of control, but also to give others tons of love, because people that make decisions that are different than you are often just working from a totally different set of chemical properties that then, you know, if you were in their shoes and if I was in the shoes of the people in DopeSec, I would be probably addicted to opiates. Similarly, if I was, you know, one of these patients, I would be having issues that might require medication due to like heart disease or something. But you can also be perfectly happy and strong and healthy at every single weight. And so, you know, it's this complex, it's holding complex thoughts in our head at the same time of loving yourself, and understanding that you can want to make small changes in yourself without discarding all of the things that make you this amazing, perfect human.
And that those changes are an element of that. I think it's what makes you you. And I think like that creates the uniqueness of all of us. And that's like actually something that should be celebrated. And I appreciate it. I think this like, this was a little complex how we weaved it together, but I hope that message comes through is just the complexity of all of us, and that like it's really cool to celebrate that.
Yeah. Do you think I did okay there?
Oh, yeah, no, that was perfect. I was a little worried about because of the debate that we had, I could sense you were worried. You're like,
I want to talk a little bit more. I mean, as the podcast grows and continues, about really complicated topics. Oh, right?
I do too. Yeah.
Because like we are the most body positive people in the world, but this is a medication that's out there that some people are taking on the podcast, and I am just want to explore those weird places where there are no answers. And the only answer to me is that like, you are loved just the way you are and you are enough and you are perfect. But that doesn't mean that you can't like, you know, love who you are and be perfect even with small changes tomorrow, whatever those are.
No, and I think we should do that because this is like a window into our dinner table conversations. We have these like very complex discussions. And I think at this point, we're past 100 episodes. And I feel like, I don't know. I hope we have the audience that understands that we're coming at this with a basis of love. And so I think we can tackle more complex topics.
Speaking of complex topics, how about shoes?
Let's do it. Actually, because we're nearing the end, let's make this a two-part episode.
Yeah.
So let's start with the science first, and we can go through some of like the biomechanical considerations with shoes and some of the new technology. And then next week, I'm pumped about this. Let's do just like a full shoe review.
Oh my gosh, this is my absolute dream.
The great part about being not sponsored is that we can speak candidly about shoes and we can take down shoes. It'll be really fun.
So next week we're going to talk shit about different shoes and shoe companies?
Yeah, it'll be great.
This is going to be so good. So if any shoe company wants to get consideration in the meantime, you can send a check to our way. We're not above bribes.
We have time. We'll also talk a little bit about like introducing very light and small amounts of barefoot running. So we'll talk about shoes and feet.
Oh, this is going to be so fun. Oh my God, we should go through each brand on next week's episode.
That'll be so fun. Oh, and just like give the dirty. And actually there's certain brands actually that I'm like kind of polarized on. So yeah, it'll be fun.
Oh, we have complex feelings. I mean, I think both of us feel differently and we're open to the idea that shoes are very different for everyone.
Oh, they're so individual.
But it is so fun to shit on shoes.
It really is.
Yeah. That's what Addie thinks too. Really fun to get her dog shit on her shoes. Okay. So, we're going to skip the part. I was going to have a big intro here about my approach to shoes more generally and why we're talking about this. Let's save it for next week. So let's go to the science more generally. There was a study in April 2022 that came out in the Medicine Science in Sports Exercise Journal that motivated this, that was all about how highly cushioned running shoes actually improve running performance, which to me was like a holy grail. It's like, I've been looking for this study for so long.
You got so excited about the study. You were bringing it up at the dinner table. And then I started diving into it and I was like, wait, buddy, this is false advertising. So I was actually perplexed by this because I feel like they should have acknowledged this, like in the abstract, very clearly in the methods, in the conclusions, in the discussion. Like it is absolutely paramount to the foundings of the study that the highly cushioned shoes had a carbon plate.
Yeah.
And they didn't say, they actually, I went through and I like barely, I can't even remember where I found it at this point, but it was like buried somewhere in there. And it was by like inference that I figured it out. And I feel like if you are making these findings, that needs to be everywhere.
Yeah, it's a very interesting, like, I wonder why. I mean, it doesn't make sense because in most studies, they actually say the shoe name somewhere in a table or something. They didn't even say the shoe name here. All they happened to say at one point was something about carbon being involved. So this results in this study that I was so excited about aren't relevant. Basically, it just says that, yeah, hey, no shit. You put a carbon plate in a highly cushioned shoe and it's all of a sudden going to be pretty darn efficient. I think we've learned that from seeing marathon results over the years. They're really, really good for running really, really fast.
And it validated the 4-5% performance benefit that we see in shoes, which again is highly individualistic. Like if you'll see data points across the spectrum on that with an average of 4-5%. But I laughed at this study because it was like, presenting it like it was this like shocking science, and it was like, yeah, no shit, Sherlock, we're just validating what we've seen in super shoe studies.
But seriously, you need to read past the abstract, something I always need to remind myself. So fortunately though, there was a study in 2016 that measured Hoka Conquest, which I guess was one of their highly cushioned shoes at the time, versus one of the New Balance running shoes, and found no difference in running economy in that particular instance. So I think in general the running economy probably depends a lot less on whether something's highly cushioned or low cushioned or something like that, much more on the foam and the responsiveness of the foam and how that interacts with the individual's like morphology and biomechanics. I think it probably is highly individual based on the studies.
And of course, whether the foam has a carbon plate.
Yes, that helps. But a lot of the foams now have a lot of those properties without actually having a carbon plate. Like I was reading about some of what Salomon's doing now is inserting like hypercritical foam in some places that acts like a little bit of a carbon plate. Meanwhile, you know, Nike has the Zoom X, the PBAX foam that's in Nike's and Speedlands and things like that, very fast. React foams in Nike's very fast. I think the game is changing based on the foams more than it's changing based on the shoe design.
That's really true. But I think it's interesting actually to dive into one thing that we think about with shoes often is injury rates.
Yeah.
And Alex Hutchinson actually just came out with a great Outside Magazine article on breaking down what we think about as classic like ground reaction forces and injury rates as you look at shoes. And so I think let's do a little bit of a deep dive on this because that I think is an important consideration for runners is, do you get injured in these shoes?
Yeah. Well, first, Alex Hutchinson is the best.
He is the man.
Ezra Klein to politics is Alex Hutchinson to running for me. I am comparing Alex to Ezra, which is a really big step if you know how much I love Ezra Klein. He is truly remarkable. So before we get into that, some of the context here. So there's been a lot of studies that have essentially tried to look at, okay, let's change the shoe that's on people's feet and measure how impact forces change essentially with a force plate. There's a 2018 study in Nature that found essentially a 10% higher loading rate in maximal shoes. You've probably heard of these. Some of the studies are talking about the strain moves up towards the hips in them. A quote from that study is, "We found that highly cushioned maximalist shoes alter spring-like running mechanics and amplify rather than attenuate impact loading." So essentially, when athletes know that they have the cushioned shoe on their feet, they're less likely to run with a form that reduces loading. They're more likely to clomp a little bit, hit the ground harder, or so we thought. That was where the science was back then.
There was also some ideas around the perceptions of feeling the ground, that if you can't actually perceive the ground and feel the ground with your feet because this maximal amount of cushioning is there, that you can paradoxically hit it harder. And this was thought to be validated again in a 2018 study in MSSC. This actually looked at 15 female athletes. Respect.
Very
cool. Not that they're including female athletes and only female athletes in the study. It's great. But they found similar findings that runners had increased impact forces and increased loading rate when running in a maximal versus neutral shoe.
Yeah.
So this was like in 2018, where a lot of that research and science was going, and actually kind of a lot where my brain was going too. Yeah. I actually struggled at first running in maximalist shoes. And so I was like, it's the ground reaction forces.
We're going to get into that next week about some of the shitting on different shoes. Yeah. I meanwhile didn't feel that way. And I think even when the science was like this, I was rationalizing it in my own head because I'm thinking, okay, this is kind of similar to the argument against helmets in football, where they say when you have a helmet, you're more likely to hit people hard with your head. And the point being, if we played football without helmets, people would die. perhaps that's kind of how I felt with maximal shoes. It was more like, this is protecting myself from injury, even if it might not seem that way based on the studies. And I think the study that just came out in the European Journal of Sports Medicine, which Alex wrote about, talks about this in a way that is fascinating. This isn't on maximalist versus minimalist. This is on soft versus firm. And I think it gets to some of these questions.
Yeah, and I think it highlights the math and how we break down loading forces in a different way that can be helpful for contextualizing these other studies too. So what they did was they had two different types of shoes, and these shoes were both made with an inch thick layer of midsole cushioning from EVA foam. And it was manipulated so that half of the shoes had soft cushioning and then half had firmer cushioning. Yes. And they were looking at the impact force on those. What I think, though, is curious about the study is that they were not looking at any variations. So just an inch thick. So there's no variations in stack height, drop of the shoes, any other factors that we classically think about with shoes. So just looking at like stiff versus soft.
Yes. Oh, gosh.
I know. I was just saying that. I was like, I teed this one up.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're almost 1:30 into the episode, so it's okay.
My brain is too slow for catching the joke or getting the jokes out. I just can laugh at the idea that a joke is there. It should exist. It is an empty space where a joke like form should occupy. So like the basic way I understood it is that as the foot hits the ground, there's like two different loading processes, right? Like,
correct. Yeah.
I'm not very good at biomechanics. It's not an area of my expertise.
I'll break this down a little
okay,
bit, but it's
you.
Also, I'm not a biomechanics expert at all as well. I love reading the research on it, but that's not where I focus my own personal like scientific research. But so there's the initial jolt that happens, and Alex Hutchinson actually did a great job breaking this down. And as the initial jolt happens, and that's like the first impact force, the lower leg is decelerating abruptly. Then there's a second force that happens, and that's the larger force that's being delivered to the rest of the body. But when we classically think about injury and tying these forces to injury, we often think of that first jolt of the lower leg decelerating. And that's what we tend to care about more in the process of thinking about how does this translate into potential injury risk for an athlete.
Yeah. And so they often measured those jolts, essentially not being able to isolate them in the way that this study did in a very ingenious way. They structured it in such a way that they could integrate the whole scope of how the impact forces were spread out across those two things, which should be relevant because we've never actually connected injury directly to how all of this works in practice. It's a little bit more complicated than that. And the study pointed out that in the complications, we might've been missing part of the story, that it might be a lot more interesting than maybe some of the studies that said, hey, maximal shoes, more impact. It's as simple as that.
I actually think that Hutchinson summarized this really well. I was going to do a breakdown of the summary of this, but actually he summarized it so well that I'm just going to read what
Let's
he said.
Let's do it.
He said, one of the effects of soft cushioning is that it slows down that first jolt when the lower leg abruptly decelerates, spreading it over a longer period of time and causing it to overlap with a second. The combination of the two impacts makes the total force appear greater, giving the impression that the softer shoes produce more force. And then it's essentially very cool math where you separate the first and the second impacts into distinct values. And when you do that, you find that the first impact, which is the one that's linked to injury, is actually smaller in the softer shoes.
Yeah.
And so that's like kind of debunking what we thought. And it's using math to transform how we've thought about ground reaction forces.
Yeah. So in other words, it's complicated. My guess is when they start to do this, it's a wash based on biomechanics and form. And what we like might have been thinking necessarily about, oh, is this shoe good or bad for what it does to my biomechanics, is actually, you can probably run in good form in any shoe. It just depends on how you feel in particular. So it also points out that don't read too much into a scientific study in a field of science right when it starts to gain prominence.
That's because, a great point.
You know, there's going to be a lot of complications that happen. And I think even this is not dispositive. Like there's going to be more on this because this is soft versus firm. What happens versus a maximal versus minimal, what happens in different types of shoe design, drop changes things. A lot of different things can change it. So all I would say is nothing is a boogeyman. Find what works for you and then, you know, go from there. And next week, we're going to dive into some tips about what works for us as we shit on different shoes.
I'm so excited for this episode. It's going to be really fun. Just an honest look into how we thought about shoes, which of course is personal. Like people are probably going to intensely disagree with us on certain topics, but we'll make it funny so that even if you intensely disagree, hopefully you can laugh.
But we're right is what we're saying. I'm right, actually, because we're going to disagree too. So you want to do Listener Corner?
Let's do it. Let's dive into this. I love this Listener Corner. It's from Kay. Kay writes, just wanted to express my thanks for your writing and advice for ultra runners out there in the world. After finishing Mountain Lakes 100 last year and not feeling great, I read your piece 5-point training checklist for almost any ultra, and it was so spot on. So in training this year, I used the Mountain Legs routine, go Mountain Legs, woohoo,
yay,
and some other strength training, and just finished Hellbender feeling great. Well, that legs feeling great, still working on the stomach. I know the Mountain Legs work was indispensable. With much appreciation, best, K. And cheers to Mountain Legs.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was thinking a little bit. So in this build, I did a little bit of biking just so that I'd be ready to bike with you, because I thought we were going to bike in your pregnancy, but I think we're probably...
I was too scared.
Yeah. And as soon as I stepped on the bike, I was able to put out like 270 plus watts for an hour without any issue. And I thought that was really, really interesting, because like, you know, that was with 8 months of not biking. And that must be Mountain Legs, right? Because it's the only thing I'm doing that's approximating that, that allows me to translate some of my running fitness into biking. And so that also probably points out why Mountain Legs can be effective more generally. Like, there is a strength element here, even though I have heard other coaches perhaps shitting on it at times.
Just one coach,
but it works. You know, tons of athletes do it, tons of pros. So thank you, Kay. We appreciate you so much. And we love you all so very much. Rate, review, subscribe, especially subscribe and rate if you haven't done that yet. It means so much to us. We have some really cool podcast things coming down the pipe soon, and I can't wait to tell you about it.
Thank you all so much. This is honestly like a joy to get to do. And thank you. I mean, I feel like the listener support we get just makes it even more of a date. So thank you.
Huzzah!
Woohoo!